From mermaids to water horses, the lore and language of Ireland have always beckoned the poet Nuala Nagano.
As a child, I was very imaginative, to put it mildly, and I saw miracles and all sorts of things. You know, like at Corpus Christi once, I saw the whole sky turn blue and I was sure it was Brathna Maidin na Mhuire, Our Lady's Mantle, and then found out in a physics book then that it was common meteorological phenomenon. Bit of a letdown, you know.
Discover how Nuala Nagano found her poetic voice and is now considered one of Ireland's most prominent living poets writing in the Irish Gaelic. This is New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam, and I talked with her before her fall 2016 reading at Rockhurst University's Midwest Poet Series. Settled in Dublin, this poet has spent her life moving between lands and languages, from the English she learned first to the Irish of her mother's family and the Turkish of her late husband. So it's fitting her work has been published across the globe, with English versions translated by the late Seamus Heaney, the New Yorker's Paul Muldoon, and others. Nuala Nagano writes her poetry exclusively in Irish, but she does write prose in English. Her book of selected essays gives insight into her creative life, fueled early by boarding school.
I didn't feel I was in the right place, and I found it very hard. And I loved the school part of it. It was an Irish language school, and the school part, I knew how that worked. You would stand on your head for the teachers, and they would stand on their head for you. It was marvellous. But then we went into boarding school, and I just didn't understand the rules of the game there. There was some sort of snobbery or something going on, and I just couldn't get it. And writing kind of kept me sane.
And then writing in Irish was your next big discovery.
I still remember where I was. I was in fifth year. I was almost final year. And I was at the back of the study. And I had a desk that looked out one of the large windows onto the beautiful grounds. I was supposed to be doing a French exercise, but I was looking out the window and I was thinking of a poem. And the words that were coming into my head were a bit like an Austin Clarke poem. And I said to myself, why do I write like an Austin Clarke poem? And then I thought, what did Austin Clarke do? Oh yeah, Austin Clarke often brought the prosody of Irish into English. He used the Irish type rhyming schemes in English. So I'm actually writing Irish, but in English. That's stupid. So why don't I write it in Irish? And I did. And the poem is much better. And I said, well, that's it then.
That was the moment.
Yeah.
Well, I just loved your selected essays, a book that you wrote in English, which is extraordinary and a wonderful look into the Irish language. But I love this particular essay because of the way that it meanders through and we learn so much about your own personal life, but also what's going on in Ireland and the history and just the way it's all intertwined with you discovering that writing was your life, and it starts with boarding school.
Oh, that's true. I was not good boarding material. Already by 12, I was a loner, well on my way to becoming a fully fledged recluse, and the forced proximity of 100 other girls, not to mention 40 nuns, was more than my nerves could stand. I got around the problem as best I could by developing a reasonably personable, extroverted personality that has stood me in good stead ever since. I hesitate to say that it is a false personality because it has grown on me like a kind of second skin. Deep down in me, though, there was a pool of pure vitriol, a seething anger that nothing could touch. I tried to dispel it by keeping a diary, but given the total lack of privacy in the place, this was a chancy business. Girls had been expelled in dire ignominy for less, sometimes just for things they wrote in letters. I countered by keeping the diary in code and in Irish, counting on the fact that the one nun who could be calculated to snoop in it had no Irish, and the only nun who had enough Irish to be able to read it was a lady to her fingertips, incapable of stooping to something so low. This journal became my lifeline, and with it began the lifelong habit of writing something every day, even if only a snippet of the previous night's dream. In a sense, this coded diary was the perfect apprenticeship for a poet, a way of using words to express something deeply personal, yet in a veiled way, the deepest core of meaning often remaining inscrutable. Seeing as I was so often distraught or emotionally overwrought, writing developed naturally as a coping mechanism, and the poems gradually grew out of this writing habit.
We just heard a little snippet from one of the selected essays by Nuala Nigano, who's probably the foremost writer in Irish in poetry.
That's being a very big fish in a very small pool.
Well, when you have the likes of Paul Muldoon doing your translations, you know, that's pretty impressive. But why don't you do your own translations?
Because I'm not a poet in English. I can prove it. I have translations in one of these books that I had to do at one stage because I didn't know enough poets in English. And I had to have translations to go to Scotland. And they're not really good. They're a kind of a mishmash of Tennyson and Keats and this and that. And I don't have the killer instinct in English that I do in Irish. And so I twist the arms of friends of mine who are poets in English.
So what do you mean, killer instinct?
You know, the rightness of a word. Getting a register right or mixing registers and knowing what you're doing when you're mixing registers rather than doing it unconsciously. I can't do that in poetry in English. I can do it in prose okay, but not in poetry. The poems come to me as rhythmical patterns and then images. And the rhythmical patterns are in Irish. And that's the only thing I can say to explain it.
Speaking of having Paul Muldoon translate your work, you have a book, The 50-Minute Mermaid, one of your more recent books. But he's done some other translations along the way.
Oh, right? He has. And at some stage, I think he's going to bring out just his translations.
Right.
But he's an old friend of mine. We met through a poem in my second book of translations. It's called As for the Quince in English, and it's called Uncrown in Irish. This came to me in the post, and there was a letter with it in Irish in very big handwriting, and it said, Tomás Mór or Gomar the Cuidibra, I really like your work and I have taken upon myself to do this. And then I read the translation and then I said, who is this so-and-so? It is extraordinary. And then I went back and Paul O'Muldoon. Oh, that's Paul Muldoon. No wonder it's so good. And then we met up afterwards and we became friends.
He's wonderful. I got to interview him.
Oh, yeah, he is.
Oh,
he's
fabulous.
And he's been very kind to me over the years.
Right.
Very, very kind.
Well, I learned from your book of selected essays, too, that there's a lot about the Irish language. It's a lot more rhyming than
It's different. It doesn't have full end rhymes, for instance, but there are an awful lot of
internal
rhyming. And then if there are rhymes in the end, they're half rhymes. And even in bardic times from 1300 to 1650, say, full rhymes at the end was considered unsophisticated. And so you have a completely different acoustic. And also every vowel in Irish has five vowels, but there are five long vowels, and then they're very important. And so you have a completely different acoustic to what you have in English.
Oh,
and obviously at some level, the deepest level of me is obviously working in that acoustic, not in English.
And it's fascinating, too, because you really didn't learn Irish until you were five.
That's true,
and
yeah.
You were born in Lancashire,
England. I was, yeah.
And then you were sent back to your mother's family.
That's right. And it was a terrible shock. And maybe I learned, clung to the language as something to save me or something. I don't know.
Well, it did save you in a way. You have that wonderful story about asking for milk and you kept wanting milk. And then finally,
I said banna in Irish and suddenly it appeared and I never looked back.
That was your doorway to that world. I'm real curious, out of the 50-Minute Mermaid or out of The Water Horse, which was not translated by Paul Muldoon, but if there's a particular poem that you think that the translation really sparkles.
Yes, indeed. Actually, I have one. It's called Tusse, and it's translated by Elaine Ní Chuileáin. And she's a very senior poet in Ireland, and she's an old friend of mine. She's been translating me for over 20 years. And she and Paul are my favourite translators. She has done a version of this poem, which I think is beautiful.
Oh, that's neat. And this is from the book The Water Horse.
Yes.
I would love to have you read it in the Irish and then the English translation.
I'll read it in English first so that you get to know what it means, and then you can listen to the Irish in a different way, maybe. You are. Whoever you are the real thing. The witness who might lend an ear to a woman with a story barely escaped with her life from the place of battle. Spring, the sweet spring, was not sweet for us, nor winter neither. We never stepped aboard a ship together, bound for America to seek our fortune. We never shared those hot foreign lands. We did not fly over the high hills riding the fine black stallion, nor lie under the hazel branches as the night froze about us. No more than we lit bonfires of celebration or blew the horn on the mountainside. Between us welled the ocean, waves of grief. Between us the mountains were forbidding and the roads long with no turning. Thusse. Is thusse pehu hain on fi rain, na hura cluis le heistuk beidr the van inch de scale, a hug na cosse le a regan o lahar an chaha. Nir hugumar fein an saur lin, na an gire. Nir rielamar ar bordling ag America an o ag laragar vartun le chéle shliarpi ins na tirhato har lair. Nir yaimar davorn an gnoc ar chap a loid darol in dhuv. Nir liamar fe crown cairin is an iha cur kishna. Ní lú ná mar a bhí tínta cnáis an airco séidir hef na gréine. Adrin bhí an arige bhúr a thá brónach. Adrin bhí na cnic is na sléite, ná casan ar a chéile.
That was the poem You Are, and the original, which was in Irish, Tusa, from the book The Water Horse by Nuala Nigono. And this is New Letters on the Air. And that was translated by Eileen...
Nichulanon.
Nich. So many Nis.
No, but Ni means daughter of. So we have a gendered... See, O means grandson of. Mac means son of. So, you know, if you're a woman, it doesn't really make sense grammatically to have a male name. It's like in Russian, you know, Molotov, Molotova, you know, that's sort of, except we do it at the beginning of the word rather than the end.
Learning about the language. It has a different cadence altogether than English.
Absolutely. Well, it's not a Germanic language for starters. I mean, English is still a Germanic language. It's a Celtic language. And so you're talking about something that has been different from the time of Proto-Indo-European, really. So it is very different, yeah.
Talk a little bit about, and you mentioned this in your selected essays as well, the history of poetry in Ireland. And we think of the bard going around and talking, but there was written poetry from centuries back.
Oh, yes. The first written poetry was written by monks. And often these monks weren't even in Ireland. I mean, one of the earliest poems in Éin Beag about a little blackbird of Lochalee, and a very famous one called Pangerbon about a white cat. And it was actually written in Germany somewhere in a Schotten cloister. And it was an Irish monk who had come via Wales, where he picked up the cat, because it's a Welsh name, to that part of the world and was, you know, bored with writing the Georgics, actually, as he was writing it out, and wrote this little Irish poem on the side. And it's a beautiful little poem. And that would have been around 800.
That is early. And yet so much of the tradition of poetry was meant to be spoken. I mean, that's how people told their
yes,
stories.
Yes, of course. And the poets then, the bards, as they became known as, they actually were more than just poets. They were genealogists. They were political advisors. They were a very important part of the local king's retinue. And they were very aware of the fact that they were very important. And so therefore, after the Battle of Kinsale, when the sociological system that underpinned them was destroyed, then they took it very badly. And they have written wonderful poems about it, their loss of status. But what happened was that it gave a new impetus to poetry, so that what came up was what had been going on among the people all the time, which were these folk songs. The meter, instead of being bardic meter, is called Madhuracht an Auráin, which is song meter. And I actually literally had to go to Scotland to discover that they had this song meter for longer than us, and that their tradition is much less fractured than ours, and suddenly realised, oh yeah, a Madhuracht an Auráin song meter is what it says it is. All these are beautiful poems had airs, and we have lost a lot of the airs to the poems, and we've lost a lot of words to the airs, and some of us are putting them together again.
Oh, and how exciting!
And that's one of the things that musicians are doing a lot of. There are 400 airs that were taken from my parish from a piper called Tomás Ó Cineda by the Protestant minister, James Goodman, and this was around the time of the famine. And he, Kinneda, gave 400 beautiful airs to Goodman, which are hardly known now. So one of the jobs I have now is I'm writing new words to those songs. And so hopefully we will have brought back all that into the ordinary repertory again.
You mentioned that about Goodman in your essay.
Well, I've had it be in my bonnet about Goodman since I was a child. They say he had a manuscript where he wrote all the words, but it got lost.
And you've dreamed.
I dreamed of finding it.
And you may yet. I mean, wouldn't that be
Well, if I don't, then I'll make up for it.
Yes, that's right. You're finding it in a different way. Mm-hmm. I learned, too, from your book of essays that you had an uncle, Thomas, your
He'd
aunt's
be my uncle,
husband.
Yeah,
yeah your
husband.
Uncle, mm-hmm. who, in a way, was your own family bard.
Oh, he was. Mind you, he wasn't very musical, but he knew all the words of the songs. But he had an area of what we call Shanachas, which means local lore. But his one was about place names, and he was extraordinary. I remember once I gave him a book about our part of the world, which is called Forbidden Hidden Kerry. And I gave it to him, and I asked him a few weeks later, well, Marsh, what do you think of it? And he said, he's all right. He goes back 200 years, but I can go back four for you. And this was for a man who wasn't really literate. I mean, who read the newspaper with great difficulty because he'd hardly ever been in school. And yet he just knew just reams of this material. And I would sit there and, you know, soak it all in.
Shanachas. Mm-hmm. Is that the poetry of place?
Yeah, that's the poetry of place. Well, Dean Shanachas is the poetry of place, but Shanachas is any kind of old knowledge. It's a very important part of Irish culture. Because for millennia, we've been walking around what is actually a really very small island and talking to ourselves about it. And it's still going on. I mean, there are places, there's a place I know as Lich Quill, and it's a rock just off my aunt's land in West Kerry. And supposedly, it is the petrified body of the last of the Fianna, Fionn MacCool's warriors who died in the Battle of Antrim. So it was known by me and my generation as Lich Quill. Now, then, younger generation calls it Patrick's Point because a boat called the Patrick from Dingle went down there a little while ago. And so they have another name for it. But, you know, why not? Things keep changing.
Yeah.
I think it's better, though, if you have all the names.
Yes, if you can go back the seven generations. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a poem I'm going to get you to read. Now, how do you say Thomas in Irish?
Tomás.
And there's a character in the poem named Tomás.
That's him, yeah.
Oh, is it him?
No, that's him.
Oh, okay. Let's hear that one.
Yeah. A remarkable admission. And the original in Irish is Advoil Huhinchach. En ur a wine ri of a mahel, a furis irith is an ledis lu o veil en dinica, grif sais egen kineglana gaffa chidica. Only one time ever in my life did I get as much as the slightest inkling from one of them. They had gone through some sort of ethnic cleansing, and that it was to some other place altogether, far, far away, they really belonged. I was 16 or so when it happened. I was deeply into biology and chemical equations. I was enthralled by physiology and hygiene, up to the eyeballs in accountancy and computing skills. I was wading across the Naa one day, my jeans legs turned up to my thighs, trailing a bit of something I'd found on the beach. I was curious about it. What class of a fish is this I have here, Thomas, I said. Is it a dogfish? The old man laid his spade down on the strand, where he had been digging lugworms. I remember they sparkled yellow, blackish green and brown as they slithered and seethed in the jam jar. That's no dogfish you have there, says he, but a catfish, a white-faced catfish. Then he lowered his voice, glanced left and right, and continued in a whisper. There's not a single animal up on dry land that doesn't have its equivalent in the sea. The cat, the dog, the cow, the pig, they're all there. Right up to the human being himself, and he's there too. The name they call him is the sea person. A dark cloud passed over his sea-green eyes that made them look like marine trenches. I'll never know what strange creatures swam around in their great depths, because just when I was about to launch into him and bend his ear about chemistry, physics, and the latest underwater explorations, he turned on his heel and disappeared. He left me hanging there, like a drowned man between two seams of water.
That's the poem A Remarkable Admission from The 50-Minute Mermaid by Nuela Nigono, translated by Paul Muldoon, and this is New Letters on the Air. You know, there's so much of your work that really looks into the Irish fascination with the other world or the land under the sea or land under the wave, I think is
That's
how
right.
you refer
That's, yeah,
to
on
it.
That's right, that's the Tír Fóthain, yeah, land under wave, yeah.
That whole mythical tradition, can you talk some about that importance to you and your poetry?
Well, when I was growing up, there would always be a level of kind of imaginative talk about the other world. I wrote it in one of my essays that I remember walking up to my aunt's house once and she recognized my footsteps because she's got a very good ear and she knew it was me. And yet when I knocked on the door, she said, "An de viúvnú de varifú, are you of the living or of the dead?" Because depending on what you were, there was a protocol about how you were approached. Like if you were the dead, you don't shake hands with them because they work on a different energy level and you get a stroke. I mean, that's the general idea. So there's always this ability to play around with the idea that there are things that go bump in the night. I heard these stories all my life, but I think I've only had one real original idea in my whole life. And that is that one day it dawned on me that all these stories were actually the projection of our inner landscape, of, you know, the unconscious of the community. So this is what was going on. And suddenly I felt I had a way into it. I can use it. I know what to do with this. And in The 50-Minute Mermaid, I mean, the whole idea is that the sea is the Irish-speaking world, but it's also the subconscious, and that people liberate themselves from it with great difficulty, come up on land onto the rocks of English.
And the sea hides the unconscious mm-hmm. from us on land
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
so
Absolutely.
Often.
Well, I mean, Freud and Jung always, well, Jung especially went on about the sea being an image of the subconscious. And of course, where I come from is where we're surrounded by sea. So it would be very strange if we didn't have that image in our dreams.
Well, one of the other books that you have worked on is the anthology of women writers.
Oh, yes, the Field Day anthology. There were three volumes of the Field Day anthology and there were 30 editors and not one single editor was a woman. And when that came out, well, there was very little Irish language stuff in it too. So when that came out, we women, you know, rose up in arms. And I was very upset about there being very few women. There were women in it. I mean, I was one of them. But I mean, there weren't anything like there should have been and no woman editor. So the Field Day group of people, Seamus Dean, who was the prime mover, really said, OK, in that case, we'll give you another volume for women editors only. And then that grew to be two more volumes. And I was asked to do the modern poetry because I could do Irish and English. So I made a selection which I tried to get two poems from everyone. I tried to put in as many people as possible and tried to give as wide a focus as possible.
Yeah. The thing that I didn't really realize is how much women poets in Ireland were in a way hidden from the Irish, too.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You know they had to exist.
Oh, yeah,
you
of course.
Know that.
I mean, they weren't in the tradition. They weren't in the manuscripts. There are extraordinary songs and poems in Madhric Tamaron in the Song Meter, written by women, obviously, about, you know, the song of the abandoned girl and all these wonderful ones. And some of the most beautiful of the folk songs are like that. But they're anonymous, so we don't know who wrote them. And there was a kind of a semi-bardic clique who, you know, took it upon themselves to be mediators between the great goddess and the great unwashed. And they were the druids, the poets. And women were not supposed to do that. We were supposed to be the muses. I mean, when my first book of translation came out, this one called Selected Poems, I had a review in the Irish Times that called me the muse of all these different poets. And I said, hold on a minute, I'm not their muse, they're my translators. And that was, you know, they thought that they were paying me a compliment. I was very annoyed.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, would they have said that to a male poet?
Not at all.
Right.
I was a very angry young woman when I was writing the poem in the 80s and 90s. I mean, a lot of the energy that helped me write came out of that anger, that I just wanted to make an even playing field. And we've done that now, so I don't worry about that anymore.
What about younger poets, women coming up in Ireland now?
We won the war. I mean, let's face it now. In Irish and in English, there are great women poets. In Irish, Alvaní Garvey from Tralee, and she has a wonderful width of imagination. She has great scope in her. And I think she's somebody that I'm really, really happy to read. But in English also, you have a whole generation of young poets, women poets, who are stunning. You know, Sinead Morrissey in the north of Ireland.
She's wonderful.
She
I interviewed
oh, did
her
you?
Not
yeah.
too long
yeah.
ago.
And right. There would be a lot in the south too. And they're doing wonderful work. And I'm really happy.
Yeah.
And I feel so thankful to have been part of the generation that allowed them not to have to worry about fighting against male poets. You know, they don't have to do that anymore. We've done that for them.
Well, let's hear another poem. I would love one that shows your sense of humor.
Well, I do the one on the Blasket Islanders, you see.
Oh yeah.
Well,
let's
do that one. The whole idea of the mermaids, in a way, is that, you know, we've come from Irish, from land under wave, up onto the mainland, onto the rocks of English. But I think we lost a lot while doing so. I know my mother's generation, they left their emotions behind in Irish, and their rational side was in English, but their emotions were in Irish, and then they wouldn't quite express them all the time. And every now and again, they would come up spontaneously and often inappropriately in Irish. And I've noticed that in a lot of people. And that's the sort of thing I was trying to tease out somehow. But while I was at it, at that time in my life, everything I read about turned into mermaids. And I had I had a thing at Bee in My Bonnet about the Blasket people, how they're made out to be some perfect Irish speakers. They're these icons. And, you know, I don't think actually they quite deserved it. So I decided to pull their leg a little bit, and I wrote this poem. Na Marúcha agus an Litríocht. Now, the translation by Paul Muldoon. The merfolk and literature. Though they could read and write their own language from the time they came out of the sea, it had been learned by the youngsters until, of course, the island school was closed down by the Department of Freshly Formed Islands because of the constant danger of rockfalls and landslides. They didn't take up their pens to actually set down a literature. They neither compiled nor composed, nor were they afflicted by any of the affectations associated with authors. They put no store in the customs and practices of the writing life and never set out to cash in on that lovely, strange world from which they'd sprung. Submarine cuisine. The Enchanted Isle. Legends from the land under the sea, not to speak of A Mermaid's Tale, are only some of the titles of books they didn't get around to writing. It's not that they don't have regrets about leaving, and many of them do indeed sigh for the old ways, only that they don't make a habit of bewailing their sad fate, for they know right well there's no going back, and though their likes will never be seen again in any shape or form, they don't go writing screeds of poetry and prose making a huge deal out of it. They leave that kind of carry-on to the crowd from the Blasket Islands.
The Merfolk and Literature by Nuala Nigano, translated by Paul Muldoon from her book, The 50-Minute Mermaid. She also read from her collections, The Water Horse and Selected Essays, while at Rockhurst University's 2016 Midwest Poet Series. The first woman appointed as the Ireland Chair of Poetry Professor in 2001, her 2017 book, Entry Permitted, reflects that time. For links, go to newletters.org. Production of New Letters Magazine at UMKC. Today's show was produced with Cassie Vaughn, Nicole Dorsey, Blake Elizondo, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.